Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.byteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest joining us from the UK is Nigel Wellings, and we are talking about his book, Why Can't I Meditate? How to Get Your Mindfulness Practice on Track. Meditation is supposed to be a practice that's relaxing and beneficial, so why is it so hard to commit to? While many people have taken workshops in meditation, a significant number don't maintain their practice for long after the class is finished. This is where Why Can't I Meditate comes in, full of practical ways to help our mindfulness practice flourish. This book also features guidance from a wide spectrum of secular and Buddhist mindfulness teachers and personal accounts by new meditators on what they found difficult and what helps them overcome those blocks. Nigel is a psychoanalytic psychotherapist who has been teaching and writing about the relationship between psycho and Buddhism for the last 16 years. He has served as a director of training at the Center for Transpersonal Psychology and is founding member of the Forum for Contemplative Studies and a facilitator on the Bath and Bristol Mindfulness Courses. Nigel's book is available from Amazon.com, and I have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. And you can also find out more by visiting the website, whycan'timeditate.com. And again, I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. So then I'd like to welcome Nigel to the show. Good evening, Nigel. Thanks for joining me. Okay. Do I have you there, Nigel?
You sure do.
I'm looking forward to chatting with you today. You know, meditation and mindfulness is a very popular topic. But I'd like to start with first, if you wouldn't mind, for the listeners who may be unfamiliar with the idea of mindfulness, would you mind explaining how you would define that and how is it that you became interested in that topic?
I became interested in the topic when I was in my late teens, I think, and I heard someone talking about meditation, and it just captured my imagination. I'm 62, so it doesn't take up too much of a sum to work out what was going on then. It was the late 60s, early 70s, and so that was the time for all that stuff. And it kind of grew from there. After university, I went to live in India. I lived amongst Tibetans. I studied meditation. I spent a little bit of a time, tiny amount of a time, in a hut up in the Himalayas practicing. And then eventually I got involved in a community of people, Buddhists, involved in meditation. And I was like that for a number of years until about 30. And then I kind of got fed up with it all. I kind of lost my way. I didn't really know what I was doing with it. And then I took a time out for about 10 years. And then I started again. And so I know what it means to stop meditating when you've started, which is how the book starts. It's a book for people who have stopped meditating but would like to start again. So in a way, the book is my own story. I guess that's what books often are. And I think the big difference between the first go at it when I was in my 20s and then the second go when I was from my late 40s, the last 20-odd years, is that the first go, I think I very much had an idea, which is very common amongst most of us, that meditation was about getting away from the person I was then. So, you know, I had thoughts, I had emotions. I wasn't very happy with the person I found myself to be. And I wanted something different, something better. I wanted to feel different. And, of course, that's the motivator that starts off most of us. Second time round, it had begun to dawn on me that this was actually using meditation to get away from myself rather than get towards myself, making friends with the self I already was. And so the second go at it's been very different, and this again is reflected in the book. It's about not using our mindfulness meditation to try to make ourselves into a different person, but to make friends with the person we already are. And that means making friends with the thoughts that we already have, the emotions we already have, and finding a way to accept the entire spectrum of our experience without picking and choosing so much, without being frightened of aspects of it. So that story, in a way, has begun to lead into, hasn't it, a definition of mindfulness. Mindfulness is a way to be present with the entirety of our experience without fear. And, of course, there are techniques that enable us to do that, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that. But I think, for a start, that's the first part of the definition I want. Mindfulness is a way to make friends, to come into relationship, to find a way to accept the entirety of our experience without picking and choosing.
Okay. Well, you know that the idea of you used your life example of being young and doing it, and then stopping, and then starting back up again. It seems that for many people, the reason for a lot of people to stop is that sometimes we don't see necessarily the benefit from our activity, and so I mean. I guess maybe some people feel that if one meditates, they're going to be experiencing bliss, and not have any challenges or, be able to. So, it seems like the idea of being present with everything, it takes into account that, there's all of the positive feeling, but also a lot of the challenges and the limitations and fears that you mentioned that still exist, and meditation doesn't preclude us from experiencing those.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I say to my students that, there are six basic emotions, happiness and sorrow, fear and anger, surprise and disgust, and our body, more or less, all of the time, is registering those basic emotions and then, variations upon them. We're never going to stop experiencing those emotions. There's no way we can weed out the fear and the anger and the disgust and keep surprise, happiness, and what was the other one? I can't remember. Pleasure. We're stuck with our entire spectrum of emotions. There's nothing going to stop that. Sometimes that's called the first arrow. It's just how things are, and there's really not much negotiation about it. But where there is a lot of negotiation is our relationship to those experiences, our relationship to having those emotions. And we can either be at war with ourselves for being the person that we are, for being a human being, or we can find a way to be at peace and at ease with the person we are. And that would mean being at ease with the entire spectrum of our experience. It's not to say that people don't try to use meditation, including mindfulness meditation, to get rid of some of those experiences. I think we probably all do, either very obviously or very subtly. But if mindfulness meditation is about being present with things as they really are. Now, that's an incredibly important phrase. Mindfulness meditation is about being present with things as they really are. Then how we are emotionally as beings is we have a whole mixture, a whole spectrum of emotions, and we have to find a way to happily be present with all of them. So, yeah, no picking and choosing. There's a lovely word here, isn't there? It's the word equanimity.
Yeah, I like that one. So now the, you know, you're a psychotherapist. So how does your training as a psychotherapist, how did that, you know, how does that enter into the book? I mean, how does that, basically affect your view of mindfulness and meditation?
Okay, that's a great question. So I've been amongst meditators and obviously trying myself for many years, and we've been teaching mindfulness meditation in an 8-week course for the last 10 years. But we've been doing it before that. What we noticed was that lots and lots of people were finishing our courses and they'd enjoyed the courses, but they actually weren't going on to continue practicing afterwards. So the first thing we thought, gosh, I wonder if that's because our courses are somehow not very good. And then we asked around other mindfulness meditation teachers and they said, no, we've all got the same problem. People are really enthusiastic. They enjoy the courses. They take something from them, but it's incredibly difficult to practice. So then I then started doing some follow-up inquiries, research really, talking to people who'd finished the courses. They were still novice meditators, struggling meditators, I call them. And through those conversations, in-depth conversations, many of which are found in the books, I began to realize that there were things going on underneath the surface of each person that were causing them to actually resist or be afraid of or become very uncomfortable with their experience of meditating. So as a psychotherapist, of course, I've got all the language for that. I understand about things that go on underneath the surface that cause trouble and get in our way. And so I use those skills, I use those ideas, and again, they're found in the latter part of the book, many, many, many of them, to understand what was this person really struggling with. So, for instance, there's an example which comes quite close to the beginning of the book where I think it's called The Elephant in the Room, where a particular lady has got quite a harsh judgment about her meditation, about her mindfulness meditation. She's heard us talking about accepting whatever experience comes up. And she gets worried because she thinks to herself, well, I actually only have really nice experiences. Maybe I'm missing something. And she gets more and more and more anxious and more and more and more critical. And eventually she stops, more or less. And what she hasn't seen is that she actually comes from quite a strict background. Her family were very, very critical of her. She's gone through her life mm-hmm. being very critical of herself. And actually, here she is again, being very critical of her meditation in exactly the way she's been critical of herself in many different ways throughout her entire life. But she didn't see it. She didn't realize she was doing the same old thing of making herself wrong and bad for having the experience she was having, which was actually, on this occasion, a good experience. And so that's where the insight was. That was the big insight that she needed to kind of catch and realize that when I find myself making myself feel bad for the meditation I've got, I just need to really notice that and include that self-criticism within my meditation practice. Not leave it outside of my meditation practice so it stops me doing it, but include it within my awareness. Oh, yeah, that's what I do. I make myself feel bad. I never feel good enough. So I think that was a very good example of how psychotherapeutic understanding, the patterns of hurt carry into adult life from childhood, are actually right there in the moment when we're sitting on our meditation stool or our seat or our cushion, and they're active, And if we can begin to notice that those patterns are there, we can begin to include them within our meditation practice, and that way stop them sabotaging it and stopping us doing it.
That's a great example. And do you feel that the practice of meditation, if the effect of meditation is for us to, you know, like be in the moment and kind of embrace, you know, everything, you know, all of our emotions, you know, that just by that act alone, that it would then bring up, like in her case, you know, that resistance, or in some cases the fear or the discomfort, you know, those things that people may have tapped down and not allowed to surface, that the meditation actually brings that up, so that, I mean, basically for whatever we're suppressing, you know, that we've kind of learned as a coping mechanism, that the meditation is kind of bringing it to the forefront for us to be able to deal with and eliminate and to overcome.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's not just my opinion. The book has got, as well as contributions, loads of contributions from meditators just like you and me, you know, struggling meditators who are finding it difficult. There's also a whole spectrum of mindfulness meditation teachers, some of them Buddhist, some of them secular, one of them neither secular nor Buddhist, but from a completely different tradition. And they 100% agree that if we actually do practice mindfulness meditation, and that means apply ourselves to it, so that's not kind of dabbing at it every couple of days for 5 minutes, it means properly practicing it, then we begin to get in touch with stuff that's difficult. So the first thing might be, actually, this is really boring having to do this every day,
right.
And I'm not getting much from it, and my bottom hurts, and my knees are even worse. And as I sit here, I can't stop thinking about, you know, my husband or my kids and all the worries I've got about them. And I have this desperate desire to get up and go and see what's in the fridge or what my emails are doing. You know,
right.
It can be pretty torturous. It can, anyone who's tried to do this knows that it's pretty torturous. So just the very act of stopping and slowing down and doing just one thing, like perhaps resting our attention on our breath or the sensations in our body, will inevitably bring us into a deeper contact with ourselves. And Pema Chodron, a Buddhist nun that I particularly like, says, we've all got this wonderful idea about meditation. I'm going to be so calm and chilled and blissful. And it's a bit like our mind is a pond or a lake. And as the water begins to still and clear, what do I see? I see all the old rubbish which has been chucked in at the bottom, all the old tires and supermarket trolleys. And it's a bit like that. It's just as you say, as we begin to slow down, we see what's going on beneath our surface. And what's going on beneath our surface is all the stuff, that much of which we don't really want to be in contact with. So that is the practice. That's where it brings us. All the meditation teachers agreed on that. If you begin to slow down, you come into contact with this type of material.
It's
okay,
not a hard
selling point, is it?
Yeah, I was just going to say, okay, now that I know that I'm gonna do this and it's going to be uncomfortable, but I got to slow my mind down and I'm going to bring up all of this rubbish. What is the benefit for someone to go through and actually commit themselves to the practice?
Well, most of that rubbish, of course, it's not that we may discover it, but it doesn't mean it's not there already. And what we're talking about is really kind of areas of anxiety, areas of fear, places
mm-hmm.
where there are emotional experiences we don't really want to go near. But of course, they're governing us all the time, aren't they? Because we're going through our lives having to control and situations and where they may come up, avoid situations where they are coming up. you know, finding ourselves angry and frightened and anxious and stressed. And all of that stuff causes us to be very reactive in our thoughts, reactive in our emotions. And it doesn't take very long for us to just sort of pause for a moment and just say, well, you know, where am I reactive in my emotional life? And every single one of us will know that there are certain buttons that we've all got, every single one of us, where they could be pushed. And the next thing, we're doing something that we probably don't really want to do, maybe saying things we don't want to say, acting in a way we don't really want to act. Yeah, either hurting others or hurting ourselves. So there's a masses of reactivity. So if we can begin to notice what's going on and just slow down a bit, we can possibly create a choice, so we can exchange a reaction for a more wise and compassionate response. And that really is where the practice of mindfulness comes in. What are we practicing for? We're practicing to be able to be more accepting of what's going on inside of us and exchange knee-jerk reactions, emotional reactions, which can often be very, very harmful to ourselves and others, but much better quality responses. So, yeah, I think that's a good place to start, and it's a realistic place to start. We can actually achieve that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, and I mean, you're right. We all have our buttons. I actually had a few that were tempted to be pushed today, but I was trying to be mindful.
Me too.
You know.
Me too.
but you know, you're right in the sense that these things are harmful to us. You know, I mean, they you know, so by bringing them up and transforming that energy, you know, we basically create for ourselves more of an internal balance, I think, or peacefulness that then would kind of, you would experience more as happiness or at least, you know, calmness versus, you know, an outburst or a reaction that only harms us and others.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, traditionally, mindfulness is said to produce two things. It's said to produce an increase in calm and an increase in insight. And one of the ways that I talk about that to our students is that if you have a glass of water which has got lots and lots of sediment in the water, and you keep on shaking it, the water remains cloudy. Of course it does. But the second that you begin to stop shaking it, you begin to calm down, and the water goes clear, then you have the clarity of the water, which is the insight. And I think that's right, isn't it? That we sit down, and someone says, "Place your attention on your breath." Every time you find yourself wandering away, so that's like 1 minute later, just notice it, bring yourself back, stay with the breath, 1 minute later, off you go again, maybe you're away for 20 minutes, then you notice it, back to the breath. With that repetition, and that's what mindfulness means, it means to remember to come back, sati. To remember to come back. With remembering to come back, our concentration begins to grow. And when we concentrate, we become calmer. And as we become calmer, we then begin to see what's going on inside of us more clearly. So there's the insight. So that marriage of calm and insight is the traditional description of the fruits of the practice of mindfulness. What are we gaining insight into? We're gaining insight into how things really are. And one of the things that we gain insight into is, oh my gosh, I'm really reactive around this particular issue. If I can just slow myself down a bit, notice what's going on in my emotions, be with my emotions in a more mindful way, then that insight will give me some more space, some more choice. I could be more responsive rather than reactive.
Yeah, very much. Now, I do want to let listeners know that if you would like to ask Nigel any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in and we'll get to them. And we're going to take a short break in a few moments. I'd like to know, you know, it seems, Nigel, that the term mindfulness and the idea of mindfulness this seems to almost come out of nowhere. It's become very, very popular. What is your feeling as far as why it seems to be on the top of everyone's mind, so to speak, now?
That's a political question. I mean, mindfulness was created in Buddhism 2,500 years ago. And so that's a hell of a lot of time. And during that time, just within Buddhism itself, it's gone through many, many evolutions. And I guess that's one of the truths of Buddhism, isn't it? That everything is in a constant process of change. Nothing remains the same forever. And that has to include also the practice of mindfulness. But there have been some enormous changes. In the 70s, it came to America through people like Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield, Insight Meditation Society. It was still Buddhist at that point. And then Jon Kabat-Zinn, whom you'll know, I'm sure most of your listeners will know, who devised the 8-week mindfulness course, Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, created a secular version of mindfulness, which was effectively divorcing it from its religious origins and making it available to anybody from any religious denomination. So that was kind of brilliant in some ways because it made it much more available. But, of course, that then starts to kind of create a possibility for a runaway thing where mindfulness now has become big business, hasn't it? And, you know, you can make your own brand of mindfulness. You can sell mindfulness, which only takes you 1 minute to do and, you know, promises you everything and delivers absolutely nothing. And so the consumerization of mindfulness is now well and truly underway. And it's difficult to know whether mindfulness is actually the medicine anymore or whether it's just another symptom. It's a difficult question.
Yeah, we know, and yeah, someone will have the mindful minute and then there'll be the mindful 30 seconds. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where, and it seems that, you know, in today's society that it's become ever more difficult to quiet the mind. You know, I mean, with so many things happening and with technology, that it just seems that it's all that more difficult. And so I'm just wondering if maybe the increase in noise, so to speak, you know, within our minds, you know, creates that an innate knowing that there's got to be some reason. I've got to be able to stop it sometime. I need to stop it because it's driving me crazy. It's so noisy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's true. But it's like any psychotherapist will tell you that often the ways that we try to make things better are exactly the ways that we make things worse. And until we work out how we're actually making it worse by trying to make it better, it just gets worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that nothing is exempt from that. There are so many things, aren't there? There's diets, there's yoga, there's a billion and one self-help techniques, and mindfulness has become one of them. None of them are really a magic cure in themselves, and that includes mindfulness. I always think of it as a bit like playing a piano. If you want to play a piano, yes, you can lift the lid and you can tinkle on the keys and you'll get something, you'll get a sound out of it, which may be quite pleasurable. And personally, it may be very pleasing. But if you want to play the piano, then it takes practice. And and although the pleasure of someone just tinkling and someone who can truly play it with some mastery may be the same pleasure, they're not the same products which come out at the end. You know, the sounds are not the same. And so I think we have, you know, if we give ourselves to something and commit ourselves and form a relationship with it, and in this case it's a practice which is forming a particular type of relationship with ourselves, a really kind, a really compassionate, a really accepting, a really inclusive relationship with ourselves, the more we practice that, the stronger the results will be. And of course there's masses of neuroscience now which is beginning to pick this up and showing the truth of that. But it does require that we properly engage with ourselves and use the tools that we have. And in this case, it's mindfulness. But, you know, mindfulness isn't a magic cure. It's not there for everybody. It's just one of many, many things.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going to take the quick break, and then when we come back, I have one question from a listener in the chat room, and then I'm going to want to talk a little bit more about meditation and, you know, if there are different ways, you know, that one can meditate versus, you know, sitting in that one position. So to talk a little bit more about meditation, okay?
Okay, good.
Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Okay.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today, my very special guest, joining us from the UK, is Nigel Wellings, and we are speaking about his book, Why Can't I Meditate? How to Get Your Mindfulness Practice on Track. And again, you can find out more by visiting the website, whycantimeditate.com. And I do have a direct link to that in the show page description. And for those of you listening who can't see that, there's no apostrophe in can't and no question mark after meditate. So it's simply whycantimeditate.com. And again, with that, we're back. Thanks for staying with me, Nigel.
My pleasure.
Great. Okay, well, as I mentioned, we have one of our listeners, Lynn, who's, again, also in the UK, and she has a question, and it says, some junior schools in the UK are teaching children as young as 7 to meditate each day to help them concentrate and get on better with their day. She saw a news report which said that it was going very well, so she would like to know what you think about that, you know, as far as the age, how it's going, and what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? In the UK, there's a course which is called .B, which lots of teachers and other people have been studying, and it's specifically there to help young children concentrate better. And I've also just recently done something for an introduction to what we call an all-party parliamentary report. So that's all the different politicians, different sides of the House in England. I've been looking at mindfulness the last couple of years, and they've just made a recommendation. I introduced that down here, and one of the suggestions they said is, yes, let's get mindfulness into school. So yeah, there's loads and loads of support for it. What I'd say about it is that it's really about the emphasizing the concentration and the calming bit of it, rather than the diving down into deeper levels part of it. And of course, that's appropriate, isn't it? Because because these are children, and just you know, breathing in a little bit, calming their minds down, just stilling them. That's going to do them the world of good. So this is somewhat different from what my book is about, which is what happens if we then take it that much further as adults. But yeah, why not? Good.
Yeah, well, you know, you're right. You know, particularly at that age, they haven't created yet or necessarily formed some of those fears or, you know, things that the resistance that may come, you know, later. But you know, the whole idea of the calming, breathing, I mean, it just is a way of being, you know. It could certainly help with, you know, areas of frustration and anger that, you know, that sometimes exist in that environment, you know, in school as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there have been critics of it. One of the criticisms is that it's not actually mindfulness, it's attentional training. But, you know, the word mindfulness is sexy and attentional training is not. So we know what it's going to be called, don't we?
really? Well, you know, yes. You know, no matter what you do, there will always be a critic. So, you know, I think there's a nature of the beast, you know. But as long as the net result is helping children, you know, live better, fuller, happier, you know, and deal with stress and tension, you know, in a more constructive way, you know, that's really kind of the key. It's kind of like, you know, I don't care what you call it, as long as it works and we have, you know, have it available for the children.
Yeah, I'm with that. And there's a lot of evidence that children are very, very traumatized. They're very, very stressed. There's an American academic who wrote a book called Body Keeps the Score, Bessel van der Kolk, who I absolutely admire. And he argues that the attentional deficit disorders that so many children are now being medicated for are actually arising from psychological trauma, and amongst the toolkit of things which would be better than medication is mindfulness, meditation. Along with other things as well. So, you know, this is actually quite a significant problem, and teaching kids to self-soothe, to be able to recognize and manage emotions that would be otherwise driving them crazy, is of extraordinary value. And, you know, my heart and mind absolutely goes out to this process.
Yeah, exactly. You know, establishing patterns early, you know, to be able to, you know, because those are the types of behaviors that they're going to, you know, carry on into adulthood. So, So now, I want to talk, first of all, can anyone practice mindfulness? Do you think that some people are, that everyone has it within themselves to be able to practice mindfulness?
I don't know the answer to that question. I really don't. I'm not even sure how we could actually answer it if I think about it for 2 seconds. What I know is that when people come to our courses and they're in the middle of a period or they're terribly anxious and they just simply can't settle, then we turn them away and we say, look, this isn't the time for you to do the course because you won't be able to do the course. You'll be too distressed, too depressed. Mm. Wait until this period has lifted, and that may lift from any form of, you know, just time or antidepressants or therapy, who knows. And when you feel more on an even keel, when you feel in a space where you can actually take something in, then come on the course. And so that you have, I'm not very fond of this word, but a tool which is waiting for you to use it next time you have a depressive period. Now that, of course, is the way these courses are meant to be taught, the 8-week mindfulness courses. That's part of the induction process. So what's that saying? It's saying if you feel really, really depressed, if you're really anxious, don't try and dive into a mindfulness course instantly to make yourself feel better. That probably won't work. Wait until you are in a position where you can take something in and establish it a bit, and then you'll have something there to help you next time dark times come along.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
because I think that most people who are maybe in that anxious, depressed type of mood, I mean, that's the time that they're going to maybe it's like, let me try anything. I can try anything to get out of this, whatever this is that I'm experiencing. And but it's good to know from your experience that it's best to wait for a more calmer period, or like you say, maybe to have that period pass and then go into doing that. Now, regarding meditation, I think a little earlier about, how your butt, your bottom hurts, your knees are, and we always have in mind the pose, of meditation, of sitting, legs crossed, and that kind of thing. Is it for people, who just don't feel comfortable in that position, are there different suggestions that you have that where people can maybe choose to meditate that doesn't require something uncomfortable that'll kind of keep you constantly thinking, oh, this is, I can't do this, I can't sit here anymore?
I guess the short answer to that is actually no, because I know there's lots of people who promise this, but I actually think the answer is no, because if you think about everything we've said, then the practice is about including all of our experience. And if we're trying to have a meditation experience, which is nothing but pleasurable, that has no discomfort in it, we are effectively trying to create a meditation which is like the rest of our lives, where we don't want anything difficult and we want everything which is pleasurable. And if the practice is about being able to include things which are pleasurable and unpleasurable and it be okay, then the discomfort isn't such a bad thing, okay? But there is a caveat here. If it becomes so uncomfortable that we begin to form a phobic response against our own meditation, then we're not going to do it. Nobody's going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they like hurting themselves, which is kind of strange. And not that
some
common.
Of those, yeah.
Not that uncommon either. But there we go. So I talk about the difference between a stretch and a panic. So we need to be willing to go a little bit out of our comfort zone. And so let's imagine we're sitting on our meditation seat and our bottom begins to go numb. If I'm going to stay in my comfort zone, as soon as my bottom goes numb, I'm going to jump up and want to sort of wiggle around a bit, go off and do something different. I'm not really dealing with the discomfort at all. If I go into a bit of a stretch, so that's beyond the comfort zone, then I notice that my bottom's going numb, and I just simply stay with the experience of what a numb bottom feels like. So what does a numb bottom feel like? Well, it feels kind of tingly and a bit dead.
Mm-hmm.
And And if I kind of stay with it long enough and kind of drop the word, I don't like this, this is a numb bottom, and just stay with the sensations, then it gets kind of interesting. Okay, so numb bottom is actually loads of different sensations, and they're all coming and going, and they're moving around. It's a little bit like an orchestra of sensations playing a piece of music. So I stay with that for a bit. And I learned something. I learned that actually I can stay with something which is initially uncomfortable. But then if I stay too long, I can actually start to make myself panic emotionally. And if I get into that place, I'm not going to want to stretch myself anymore. So it's important we don't do it too long and create a panic, because the panic will just drive us straight back to the into the comfort zone, and we won't stretch anymore. So finding that balance, and of course nobody can tell you how to do it. Every single person has to find what their own measure of this is part of the practice. Can I just stay with that numb bottom, with that knee, with that emotion, with that thought, just a little bit more, but not so much that I panic myself.
Right.
And that way we kind of stretch and stretch and stretch. Yeah?
Yeah. That makes sense. Now, in your book, you have some tips that you offer readers. Can you maybe share a sample of what the reader could expect, you know, from your book?
Yeah. There's one thing in the book which is the most important thing in the entire book, and if we were to pick this book up and just kind of gut it for this one thing, then the book would have done its job, really. So I talk a lot about feeling our emotions in our body. Sometimes this is called a felt sense, sometimes it's called interception. But it's the natural ability that every single one of us already has, which is to feel whatever emotion we're experiencing in our body physically. So if I'm feeling happy and I say to myself, where am I feeling that in my body? The chances are I'm going to feel it in my chest somewhere. And if I'm feeling, let's say, anxious and I say to myself, where am I feeling that in my body? Chances are I'm going to be feeling it around the solar plexus, gut somewhere. Yeah. If I'm to say to myself, I kind of feel choked up and I can't really express something, chances are I'm going to feel some constriction in my throat. So the point is that our emotions are deeply physical and that they can be identified in our bodies. Now, so that's the basic thing. That's what nature gives us. So we can turn that into a mindfulness meditation. So let's go back to the buttons being pushed, okay? That happened to us today. So we go back to the button being pushed, and we say, so maybe the people listening can do this. When my button got pushed, where did I feel that in my body?
Mm-hmm.
So we're dropping the storyline about it. This horrible person did this to me. I got caught in this traffic jam. My kids are driving me mad. We drop all the storyline, and we just simply go to, where did I feel that in my body? And then resting our attention in that place, feeling the emotion that is present in the physical sensation, maybe breathing around it, just allowing it to be there. We just stay there. And then after a while, because every emotion only has its own shelf life and not any longer, we'll notice that emotion eventually begins to dissolve and evaporate. Of course, if we go back to thinking about it, back to the storyline, we're going to kind of start it all up again, and it will just keep on going and going and going for however long we do it. But if we drop the storyline, practice dropping the storyline, just going to the felt sense, feeling it in our body, breathing, not trying to get rid of it, not trying to change it, not trying to understand it, we will notice how it comes, and then eventually it goes. So that is the key technique in the book. It's called making our felt sense mindful, being present with our felt sense, being mindfully present with our felt sense. So let's say now that the felt sense, the emotional reaction, doesn't come from our kids or from someone at work or the traffic jam. It comes from something that's going on in the meditation itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting here, and my mind's going mad. That's the typical experience for most people when they first start. I have no control over my mind whatsoever, and it feels horrible. Well, we've got a choice point there, haven't we? If we just simply react, then we're going to jump up. This feels horrible. I'm going to watch the telly, turn on the TV, turn on the radio. But if we notice that feeling horrible is a place in our body, okay, so this feeling horrible when I'm doing this meditation, I kind of feel it in my chest a bit and in my guts a bit. So I'm just going to rest my attention there, just breathe around it and just allow it to be there. And in that way, the impulse to stop meditating, the desire to not want to meditate, and this isn't just mindfulness, it could be any meditation actually, we actually incorporate that not wanting into the practice and just allow the not wanting to be there. And of course, what we see if we do it this way is that the not wanting arises. I don't want to do this. But if we stay with it, it melts away and then we can continue. So in this way, all the obstacles, all the hindrances to our mindfulness practice get, as it were, reincorporated into the mindfulness practice and become the practice itself. So, one of the chapters is called, I need to make sure I get this right, it's called Grabby, Grumpy, Sleepy, Jumpy, and Maybe. I'll say it again.
Mm-hmm.
Grabby, Grumpy, Sleepy, Jumpy, and Maybe. Okay, and these are called in mindfulness world the five hindrances. So the first two, grabby and grumpy, are wanting and not wanting an experience. Wanting and not wanting an experience. Sleepy and jumpy are sloth and torpor, going to sleep and being anxious and agitated. So obviously those two make it very difficult to practice. And then the last mm-hmm. one, maybe, is doubt, where we sort of think, why on earth am I doing this? This is a complete waste of time. It's completely unpleasant. I think I'm going to have a drink of beer. So that's doubt, which can really undermine the practice. So all of those things can be felt in the body. I can feel that I don't want to do this. I can feel that I want another experience. I can obviously feel when I'm sleepy, and I can feel when I'm agitated, and I can feel when my mind is kind of sowing seeds of doubt. So I can either jump up and respond to those, I don't like this, I'm going to go away and do something different, or I can notice them and say, okay, where am I feeling that? I'm just going to stay with that. Just allow it to be there and notice how it comes and goes. And that way we use all the things that would normally stop us practicing to keep us practicing. So the obstacles become the practice. That is the essence of the book. That is the absolute essence of how the book works. And there are loads and loads of tiny technical details to kind of support that. But that is the key idea within it.
Well, that's great. I mean, yeah, the people in the chat room, you know, could easily resonate with what it was that you were saying. I guess we're already down to the last couple of minutes here. I didn't realize that, Nigel, that our hour has just flown by for me.
I'm sorry, I've chatted too much.
No, sir. You are absolutely perfect. You can tell your wife that. are there any final thoughts that you may want to share with the listeners that maybe we didn't cover? Maybe any final words before we conclude?
Yeah, kindness and compassion. We haven't talked about that at all. This entire venture has to be done within an atmosphere of kindness and compassion. None of us are any good at this. We're all rubbish at it. That's why we write books about it, because we can't do it. and we, you know, to be human is to be frail and not very good at things and to muddle along. Any form of ambition or perfectionism is just more cruelty. We need to be so kind about having to come back to this a thousand times and, you know, and continuously be rubbish at it. That's okay. That's where we start.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, Nigel, this has really been a delight. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I had a good time, and I know our listeners as well as very insightful. I learned a lot. So, again, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I enjoyed talking to you as well. Thank you for inviting me. All the way from America.
Pleasure.
Amazing.
Absolutely, yes. You're international. So make sure you tell your wife that you're perfect. You're American, new American.
I'm going to rush downstairs and do it now.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ron. All right. Okay, again, everyone, today. Thank you. Good night. Again, everyone, my very special guest today has been Nigel Wellings. Again, he's joining us from the UK, and we've been speaking about his Why Can't I Meditate? How to Get Your Mindfulness Practice on Track. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, whycantimeditate.com. And there is a direct link to that website in the show page description. And if you go to the website, you'll be able to see excerpts from the book and more about Nigel and also contact information. So definitely check out his website. His book is also available from Amazon.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.